I am hoping that even though the subject matter is very weighty, that the program tonight will be a little bit lighter in terms of our discussion. Well, hopefully we can discuss these matters in a relatively cheerful way, because thank God we're all alive. And I give everybody a bracha, we should all live for a long time. And may rest in shana, be as God said it. So, there's a pasuk in Koheles that says, v'chayitein el libo, that a living person is supposed to place it to their heart, matters that relate to death and dying, because it gives us a better perspective on what we're supposed to be doing in life. The importance and the enormity of every single minute of our lives, every day of our lives. Rabbi Eliezer says in Masechta Shabbos that Shuva Yom Echad Lifnei Misaska, that every person should do tshuva one day before they die. So his student said, but how do you know what day that's going to be? He said, that's my point. You don't know, so therefore you should do tshuva every single day. You should try to accomplish as much as you can every single day to really recognize that this life is a tremendous gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we recognize that the way that Hashem set up the world is that there is a circle of life, there's a cycle of life, that a person lives a certain amount of time, and the way of the world is that individuals pass on to the next world afterwards. There's a famous comment or discussion in the Sefer Geshev HaKayim that was written by Rabbi Yechiel Michal Tuchinsky, in which he goes through all of the laws of death and dying and mourning. It's a fascinating Sefer because he takes you through every single step that's supposed to be followed when a person is about to pass away. Sometimes you can't tell when that moment is going to take place. And everything that he said should be done in respect to opening up the windows in the room and lighting a candle and reciting the Shema. Everything was done to the T. When he was holding by the end of his life, and his family was with him, and somehow they were able to observe every single halakha that he spelled out in his sefer. It was a very beautiful passage to the next world. So he wrote that just like when a baby is born, that there is a tremendous amount of crying that takes place because the baby has been traumatized to leave the mother's womb. Let's imagine you had two twins that were inside of the mother's womb. So the one twin sees the other one is going out, so that twin would be under the impression this is the end. They're leaving the protective area of the mother's womb where they're getting all the nourishment and all the care that they need. And it's a terrible, miserable moment, and they don't realize that on the other side of the womb, everybody is screaming, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov, that it's a tremendous joy, it's a tremendously happy moment that this child has passed on to a world of the living, where they're going to be able to live a very full and rich life. So he says that the same thing is true when people pass on to the world to come, when they die over here. So everybody who's inside the womb of this world, so to speak, thinks that this is a traumatic moment, and indeed for us it is very traumatic, but on the other side of the spectrum where the person is going into Olam Haba, there's a tremendous rejoicing and there's a Mazel Tov, so that's something to bear in mind as well when we speak about these issues. At the same time, there is a very strong emphasis in the Chazal of V'chai Behem V'lo Shiyamus Behem, that we're supposed to live to the fullest, and we're supposed to really extend life to the fullest. We don't believe in terminating life. There was a person, I think he was related to one of the immediately passed mayors of Chicago. It was Rahm Emanuel. So he had, a brother, Ezekiel something, who made a statement. He's involved in medicine, that he thinks it would be ideal that everybody take some sort of a potion when they're in their mid to late 70s and they've lived a full life, and this way then they can just terminate their lives right then and there, and they don't have to deal with all of the suffering that occurs when people live much longer than that, and sometimes they have terrible illnesses and terrible yisurin. So he said he thinks that would be a very good solution to all of these problems. You wouldn't have all of these healthcare resources and shortage of resources. Just everybody takes some potion and they say goodbye to the world at that point in time. So we think that's crazy. Because first of all, there's a pasuk in Yechezkel that says "Hanefashos liyeh," that it's not up to us to extinguish our lives at any point in time. That prerogative belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The pasuk says in Parshas Noach, "Hachastimchem l'nafshoseichem edrosh," that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will hold us accountable for terminating a life, even if it's going to be out of compassion, because you want to save somebody from the pain and suffering. We're not allowed to take our own lives. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik points out that the pasuk in Parshas Noach, it says, "Miyad ishachiv edroshes nefesh ha'adam." What is this coming to add? You know that you're not allowed shofek dam adam, you know, damo yishofek. You're not allowed to kill anybody. You're not even allowed to kill a fetus. So what is it adding when the Torah says, "Miyad ishachiv edroshes"? I'm going to hold accountable every single person as nefesh ha'adam who takes it out, who snuffs out somebody's life. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, this is a reference to a mercy killing. That you might think, okay, I'm not committing murder, but somebody is suffering very terribly, so I just want to help them escape from all of their yisurin, all of their afflictions, and avoid the pain and the suffering. So that also is prohibited according to the Torah, that we say that it is up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is the owner of all of our lives, is the owner of all of our bodies. It is not our prerogative to take it away. Rabbi Hananya ben Tradio was tortured terribly by the Romans. He was one of the Asar Aruge Malchus. They wrapped him up in tufts of wool and they put it on fire to slow his death and to prolong the torture. And there was a question as to whether he should just open up his mouth in order to have the fire go inside so he should die more quickly. So he said, "I'm not going to do that because mutav shidlena mishinosna ma'yachol huviatzmo." That it is preferable, and in fact it's mandatory, to wait until the Kodesh Baruch Hu takes our lives and not to take our lives ourselves. It's not something that we're supposed to do. So we believe that even if it's difficult, you're certainly never allowed to engage in what is referred to in the medical community as active euthanasia. You're not allowed. Somebody is on a ventilator and they seem to be in the process of dying. So we don't believe in pulling the plug. You're not allowed to pull the plug, even if the person is appears to be suffering. You're never allowed to engage in an active type of action that's going to extinguish a person's life. In fact, when we have an individual who is a gosis, a person who is in the very, very final throes of life, of going through the dying process. Nowadays, it's very difficult to define who's a gosis. A gosis generally means a person who is in the last 3 days of life. So you're not allowed to even touch the person a little bit, because the person is likened by the Mishnah to a flickering candle. A flickering candle, you just touch your finger a little bit by the candle and you're going to snuff it out. It's going to be the end of the candle. So you have to be especially careful not to even close the eyes. It says that the Mishnah Masechta Shabbos of somebody who is a gosis, because that's considered to be an act of besichah. Harei shofech dam, that's considered to be an act of murder. Once there was a discussion between Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who was one of the great poskim of our generation, passed away 20 years ago or so. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was very close to Dr. Abraham Steinberg, who's a major expert when it comes to medical halacha and ethics. And Dr. Abraham Steinberg and he were having a discussion where Dr. Steinberg asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, "Can you define a gosis?" Nowadays, we have such advanced medical technology where it's considerably more practical and possible to extend a person's life for more than 3 days, even if they are in terribly dire and critical states, in a terminal situation. So how do you define somebody who's in their last 3 days of life? So Shlomo Zalman turned to Dr. Steinberg and said, "Ata harofe?" He said, "You're the doctor, I don't know. You're the one who has to make that assessment." So doctors, even doctors nowadays, don't know quite how to make that assessment. But you have to realize when a situation is very, very precarious, you have to be even more careful about messing around even the slightest bit where there's somebody who is in the final stages of their life. So we believe that there is a very strong value towards a prolonging life, even if there is, let's say, an avalanche of some sort, and a person is buried by rubble, and it's a question on Shabbos whether to excavate the person. So if we don't know, it says the Mishnah in Maseches Yuma, we don't know whether the person is alive or dead. They're probably dead, but there's a remote chance that maybe they're still alive, so you're supposed to be Machal Shabbos. You have to do everything that you can in order to excavate the rubble, even if you're going to do a major malachos, a major violations of Shabbos, because pikuach nefesh is doka Shabbos, to save somebody's life, override Shabbos, even if the person is very likely going to be dead, and says the Gemara, afilu l'chayisha, even if you're only going to save the person for 2 minutes, you're going to go through all that trouble, and it's clear, based on the state in which you find them, buried by all of the rubble, that they can't possibly live for more than a few seconds or so. It doesn't matter. We go all out. We go all out on Shabbos. Certainly are going out during the week as well, that we do everything in our power. This is why it's very difficult when one discusses this topic and we speak about the types of non-interventions, the types of palliative care to provide to people who are in their last stages of life, how we want to make the journey as pleasant as possible. A person shouldn't endure so much pain. It is important, I find, especially nowadays in the world that we live in which almost every article that I read in the newspaper by medical ethics professionals or by physicians and the like is all about how we should make it easier for people to die. So I just want to reinforce, because you have to start out by reinforcing that the halacha does view it as a desideratum to prolong life as much as possible. So we do believe very much in prolonging life. Now, prolonging life is not always 100% identical with prolonging death. The Gemara in Tzuvos talks about how there was a case with the famous Tana, who was the codifier of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Rebbe. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the greatest rabbis of all time, when he was in his final stage of life, he was in a lot of pain and suffering, but all the Talmidim wanted him to stay alive as long as possible, so they were saying to him, they were all davening for him outside, and he's on the inside with his Amsa de Bei Rebbe, with the Shifcha, the maidservant, who's taking care of him, meaning they had caregivers back then as well, very faithful caregivers back then as well. So Rebbe had his caregiver, and the caregiver often really understands the person's state better than anybody else, and they're all davening, the Yakufu Atatodim Eshalyonim, that the forces here on this earth, namely the Talmidim, who wanted Rebbe, the students who wanted Rebbe to remain alive, so they should be able to overwhelm those forces above that are trying to take out, to bring an end to Rebbe's life. But then the Amsa, the maidservant, saw how much he was suffering. He had a terrible stomach ailment, and it was just an impossible existence. So instead she realized that the correct prayer was Yakufu HaElyonim Esatachtonim, that it would be better for the upper realms who were in the process of extinguishing Rebbe's life to prevail over the efforts of those in the lower realm who were praying to keep Rebbe alive. So she realized she needed to do something to distract all of the students from praying, because as long as they were praying, the prayers were very efficacious in terms of keeping Rebbe alive, but they weren't really prolonging life, they were just prolonging death. So she took a jar, and she threw the jar from the rooftop of where Rebbe was to the ground, and made a large crashing noise that distracted the students momentarily. They stopped praying, and then Rebbe's soul was able to depart peacefully. So based on this passage in the Gemara, the Ran, Ben Nissim, as a comment that he says that sometimes the acts of Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick and taking care of the sick, requires not davening for the person to remain alive, but davening that the person should die peacefully when it's clear that there's no realistic chance that the person is going to recover. We don't believe that there is necessarily a value in prolonging dying. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach tries to reconcile these different passages. On the one hand, you have the Mishnah in Shabbos, the Mishnah in Yuma, that talks about how you go to great lengths and efforts in order to excavate rubble, so a person who presumably would be in terrible pain is going to live for another couple of seconds, and at the same time you have this Gemara in Ksuvos about the death of Rebbe that indicates that it was a good thing, because the opposite of the Rebbe, the way the story is presented, it's presented like the maidservant, the caretaker of Rebbe did a positive thing. That indicates that there is a moment in time in which it's not appropriate to continue with all of our heroic, extraordinary, and aggressive efforts to keep a person alive at all costs. So he says, well, there's a certain point in time in which you pray that the person be spared from their suffering, that they be able to move on, but medically, you still do everything in your power in order to keep the person going. So not everybody is so sure about that interpretation. Nowadays, we don't pray for people to die. We just had in West Rogers Park over a Shabbos, we had my Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schefter Schlichter, who was speaking, and somebody asked him a question about at what point do you stop making a mishavera for a person to get better, to have a refuah shleima. So he quoted that many poskim nowadays just say that when a person clearly has no realistic chance for recovery and it doesn't make sense necessarily to pray for a miracle, you just pray for rachamei shemayim. You pray a Kodesh Baruch Hu should ra habakmin, but Kodesh Baruch Hu should have mercy. The Gemara in Brachos in the Abiyuda Min Aleph says, "Apilu cherev kadem menechas at sabava shel adam ayimano atzmo min arachamim." That even if there is a sharp sword that is about to pierce a person's throat, they shouldn't give up from rachamim. Rachamim means mercy. Mercy is always a relevant consideration. Even if a person is definitely going to die, there's a more merciful way for a person to go. So mercy is always something that's appropriate to daven for. The Be'er Moshe, the Devet Sina Rav, Zichrono Levracha, has a tshuva in his response to collection in which he says at a certain point in time, you daven that the person should endure as little pain as possible, that they shouldn't have to suffer from pain, that there are different formulations. People are sometimes uncomfortable saying, oh, this person, they're in the final stages of Alzheimer's, they should have a refuah shleima. The words don't sound right. Even if they should have a refuah shleima, say the person should suffer as little as possible, should have the mercy of heaven should be extended to this individual. It's a different formulation. So the Stifel Gaon, who was one of the great rabbis in Israel, we know from this the past couple, few generations, I had the privilege of visiting the Stifel Gaon when I was a young student learning in yeshiva in Israel. It was the last year of the Stifel Gaon's life. He was born in the 19th century, so I had a chance to visit with the Stifel Gaon. He looked different from people nowadays. Different. I don't know people who look like the Stifel Gaon look. It was a different out of this world appearance. It's something that I can't really describe. So the Stifel Gaon, a very, very holy man, so he wrote a series of letters called Kreina di Garta. And in his letters, he writes that when he was growing up, he always heard, he always understood that there was this value that I was summarizing at the beginning of the presentation, that a person should try to remain alive no matter what. At all costs, we keep a person going for every additional second, no matter how traumatizing it might be, no matter what types of heroic efforts it requires. But then he said, I started looking at some of these Gemaras, like the Gemara about Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and he realized it's not necessarily true, that there comes a point in which the suffering is so acute, it's so terrible, that it's not considered to be a chesed. It's not considered to be an act of compassion, or even something which is required or desired by a Kodesh Baruch Hu to just treat a person with every single aggressive treatment and procedure that is out there, and to make them incredibly uncomfortable with all kinds of tubes and all kinds of intubations and whatever you're going to do. At a certain point, you're not prolonging a person's life, you're only prolonging a person's death. And therefore he said that he thinks that when a person is really, really in the final stages, what we would define as a gosei, so then it is appropriate to withhold certain types of aggressive treatment. So the Ramah, when he codifies the laws of what one is supposed to do when they are dealing with a sick person, this is in Yoredeya, so the Ramah writes that if you have a person who's in their final stages, it's not appropriate. You see that maybe the pillow that they're lying on is keeping them alive, so it's not appropriate to pull the pillow out from underneath their head, because that's considered to be active euthanasia. That's even a person suffering, you're not allowed to engage in a killing process. That we never allow, according to halacha. But if what's keeping the person alive, I don't know how this works metaphysically exactly. I don't think that this is that there's a medical explanation for this. But what's keeping the person alive is that there's a wood chopper who's chopping wood right outside of the hospital room. So the soul is so distracted or bothered by the wood chopping, you can't go peacefully into the next world. So then you can tell the wood chopper to stop chopping the wood and allow the soul to depart peacefully. So this is all that's based on a passage in the Sefer HaChassidim, and it's consistent with this passage regarding Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So there's a difference of opinion amongst the contemporary poskim. What do we do with all of this information? How do we reconcile these two disparate poles? So according to the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg's Zichrono Livracha was the posek, the unofficial posek, I think. I'm not sure if he was the official posek, not 100% sure. Certainly the unofficial posek of Shari Tzedek Hospital. So he said, well, we have this pasuk in Yechezkel and Nefashos Lihena, that all of the lives are basically in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, we have no right to mess with an individual's life. That's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Our job is to keep the person going as long as possible, even if they're going to suffer terribly, even if they're begging us to stop treating them and to stop engaging in aggressive treatments because they're suffering terribly. Says all of the Gemaras that talk about dropping a pitcher and distracting people from davening or telling a wood chopper to stop chopping wood, like the Sefer Chassidim talks about. He says that's only with respect to extraneous things that have nothing to do with medical treatment. That has to do with metaphysical factors. Okay, so you could withhold metaphysical intervention. But in terms of medical intervention, says that you have to do to the fullest. That's the most extreme position. That's not generally the position that's followed, at least, by my own Rebbe. My own Rebbe, I'm more inclined to follow the position of Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein, the great posek for all of America, and considered to be the Gadol Hador, the greatest rabbi of his generation, was still basically following the rulings of Moshe Feinstein, even 40 years, close to 40 years now. After he passed away. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has said, no, that really that the approach that we follow is that when a person does not want any additional treatments that are going to prolong the dying process and the pain and the agony, so then it's not proper to cause a person to suffer in this particular fashion. And if we don't know what a person's wishes were, we have to assume that they would have wished that they're not going to be kept going when it's going to be futile and it's just going to prolong the dying process. So he says that although the basics for comfort have to be provided in terms of oxygen, you don't deprive a person of oxygen, you can put them on a ventilator, you give them the ability to breathe, and others add nutrition, hydration, those are considered to be the big three, oxygen, nutrition, and hydration. So those all have to be provided, but in terms of you're going to perform an experimental surgery, that even if it's successful, it's just going to cause the person to be in more terrible suffering until they're ultimately going to die. There's no cure for their illness. So he says you don't have to, and you're not even supposed to engage in these types of treatments. He quotes a Beis Lechem Yehuda, who's a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch. Beis Lechem Yehuda says that even if the person doesn't look like they're suffering so badly, but they're clearly in the final stages of the death, so the soul is suffering. The soul wants to move on. it's clear that the soul wants to go already to the next world, and therefore you shouldn't impose all of these additional treatments. That's the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Obviously, if there is a treatment that could really work, or a person has a meaningful quality of life, that they're able to interact, they're able to be with family, they're able to enjoy smachos, they're able to say a good Shabbos to somebody, they're able to do all of these things, so it's a different calculation. It's you require a lot of rabbinic expertise to figure out exactly where you draw the line, but that was the approach of Moshe Feinstein. Then there was sort of the intermediate approach of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, one of the great poskim in Eretz Yisrael. I mentioned already, right, Shlomo Zalman. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that he thought that really ideally a person should want to have the kapara. They should want to have the atonements of whatever suffering would accompany the end of their life, because even one moment of tshuva in this world is worth more than all of chayei olam haba. The Mishnah says all the world, all of the living in the world to come, and they'll get a tshuva from the suffering. So we encourage a person that they should want to endure whatever suffering is going to come through prolonging life. Prolonging life is always the best thing. But if a person says, I really can't handle it, this is not what I want, so then it's not necessary under those circumstances to prolong the person's life. There are some slight differences between Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe. In other ways, Rav Shlomo Zalman felt if a person says they don't want the basics, they don't want the nutrition and the hydration, that they'll have some palliative care where they won't notice that they're not getting the nutrition, they're not looking for the feeding tube, whatever. So you don't, so he said, Rav Shlomo Zalman says, you have to force this. You have to force it to the basics, he says, you have to force upon people. He took, they took a very strong view with respect to the essentials, but Moshe Feinstein didn't take as strong a view. But what comes out, both according to Moshe Feinstein and according to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, is that if a person signs a healthcare proxy in their lifetime, which they make their wishes known, some people might have the approach of a Tzitz Eliezer, that they want interventions no matter what, and no matter what the cost is going to be to their suffering, they just want to be kept going for every last possible moment, even when it's going to be completely futile. Some people might take that approach, but my sense is, many people don't really have that approach. So if a person really would prefer that these types of extraordinary treatments not be provided, that they not be constantly resuscitated in a way that their ribs are going to be broken over and over again and so forth, and they wanted to sign some type of a healthcare proxy that would give the authority to a rabbi whom they trust to make these determinations. So according to Rav Moshe, one would be able to make an assessment that it's not appropriate to continue treatment even without it. According to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, certainly if you had such a document, you can make that type of a determination. So that's something which is encouraged, that people should make their wishes known during their lifetime. They should sign such a document. The document would really just give authority to a particular rabbinic figure whom they trust to make these decisions. It's what we call the halakhic healthcare proxy. You have a copy in your materials, which has really two important elements to it. One, that it appoints a proxy, could be a member of the family, a child, or a couple of children, who else you are going to work, or some other family member, a close friend, who that the individual trusts to be a spouse, who's going to be consulted with respect to whenever a decision needs to be made about their health care, when they're no longer able to make the decision themselves. Number two, it appoints a rabbi, usually with a backup rabbi as well, who shall be consulted with respect to any kind of halachic determination. I get calls sometimes very late at night, all kinds of odd hours and times and so forth, where people actually call with these questions, where the rabbis are called upon them to make these determinations, utilizing to the best of our ability our understanding of the halacha, but also armed with the understanding of the person's preferences as they have expressed them, either through this document or through their communications and conversations with family members who are in touch with us. And then we're able to make an assessment of what is the appropriate course of conduct are going forward with respect to this individual. So this really can be a game changer. And it provides a certain amount of peace of mind. You know that people can live longer and more successfully when they have peace of mind in general. So somebody has the peace of mind that they know, okay, even if they're not going to be able to make a determination, a certain rabbi whom they trust will be called upon. That gives a peace of mind, which itself can be very beneficial and therapeutic to the person's well-being. In terms of whether you actually give the hospital a document that, in addition to spelling out the name of a rabbi, says, oh, and if such and such occurs, I don't want to be resuscitated, I don't want to be treated, I don't want this treated, I have that. That's more dangerous. That's more dangerous because in a hospital setting, there are other utilitarian considerations, shall we say. And sometimes if they're presented with a document that says, DNR, do not resuscitate, it's not such a big jump for them to interpret that in close call situations as a DNT, as a do not treat type of document, which the person may not have had in mind. So it's better that the person simply let their wishes be known privately. They can let it be known to the rabbi, let it be known to their healthcare proxy, but to put it in the document that the hospital is going to have might mean that the rabbi never gets consulted altogether. So I'm not in favor of having those options in the document itself. And in fact, if you look at our halakhic medical directive, it doesn't have all of those options. It has a couple of default propositions, such as that a person, that we believe in speedy burial, that we don't believe in active euthanasia, that we don't believe in autopsies as a general rule. So those things are spelled out because those are relatively non-controversial in terms of a Jewish law perspective. But in terms of the specifics of what treatments to be provided or not to be provided, it's best for that to be left to the discretion of the rabbinic authorities based on an understanding of what this person's preferences are in general. And that is what we deal with on a regular basis. In fact, these types of questions have become so prevalent and have become so much of a concentrated part of the shilas that get asked to rabbis nowadays that there are now more courses that are being offered to rabbanim all over to train rabbanim, shul rabbis, specifically with respect to how to deal with end-of-life shilas, because now these shilas are being asked even more than other types of questions like, is my pot or pan, you know, kosher because I cooked the wrong type of food in my pot or pan? Getting many more end-of-life shilas, and this really requires dina nefashos, it requires expertise, it requires a tremendous amount of sensitivity. But I reiterate that despite the fact that the Stifel Gaon points out, Moshe Feinstein points out that we don't always believe in prolonging dying, number one, if a person really wants to have their life extended no matter what, that has to be respected as a matter of halacha. Number two, there are situations where the medical establishment is sometimes ready to give up, but when we actually intervene, we are able to keep a person alive in a way that everybody would agree is considered to be meaningful and valuable and essentially from a halakhic perspective. I remember my wife and I have a friend that is a family friend of my wife's parents in New Jersey. He has a heart condition, and everybody in his family, all his parents, his siblings, everybody died young from a heart condition. It appears to be some sort of a genetically transmitted problem. And this person was in the hospital, and he was in a coma, and he was in a very, very bad state, and he was hooked up to a ventilator, and they were giving up on him. They wanted to disconnect him from the ventilator. He had those who were his family relatives, who were the closest of kin, were not observant per se, so they didn't have a sense that there's a problem with disconnecting a ventilator, but they knew that he had some sort of a rabbinic connection in terms of his relationship to my in-laws. They were Orthodox Jews, so they were very close to him. So they called them up. What did they think? So they said, okay, well, we'll ask my son-in-law, who's a rabbi. So they called me up and I said, you can't disconnect somebody from the ventilator. So we're not going to be able to stop the family from doing that indefinitely. So I said, what's the prognosis? They said they're convinced that even if by some miracle he should be able to breathe on his own again, from the lack of oxygen that he had, that there's no question that there's going to be severe brain damage, and there's just really no point under the circumstances. So I said, you know what, give it 24 hours. Give it 24 hours, see, you know, maybe he'll snap out of it, maybe, you know, he'll come out of the coma, see what happens. 24 hours later, he was up, he was awake, he was communicating, he was talking to people, and didn't suffer any brain damage at all. And this is now 8 years later. 8 years later, he's living the same normal life that he had beforehand. Same normal life. He's not connected to a ventilator. He's not in the hospital. He's home. He has a heart condition. He's living life. They were ready to pull the plug at that moment in time. There are many such stories. After the halacha has obviously divine wisdom behind it, there's a reason that we don't do certain things, that we don't allow certain things. You have to be very, very careful. Because we do believe in respecting and honoring every single life, even when a person looks very bad because they're connected to all kinds of tubes and the machinery and they're having difficulty breathing. Sometimes after a couple of procedures, a person will be able to be revived and they'll be able to leave the hospital and they'll be able to have a meaningful life. Or even if it means just keeping the person in the hospital for a few months, but they're able to have a sense of palliative care and comfort, and have a connection with their family and enjoy what's going on in the family life. We believe that every single moment is meaningful. So I want to underscore that all of these discussions in Rav Waldenberg, from Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, they're really talking about when there's no hope whatsoever and you're trying to deal with the last days, the last moments of a person's life, whether you stop administering treatment. But when there really still is hope that you can accomplish something meaningful, it's a totally, totally different story. There are situations of persons at end stage heart disease, end stage lung disease, end stage this, end stage that. Okay, there are different considerations about maybe discontinuing treatment or not continuing a certain type of aggressive treatment. That's a different calculation. But by and large, all of the poskim agree that you give a chance as much as possible, even if consult with the biggest doctors, with the biggest experts, and you give a chance for now this unbelievable medical, you know, technology and medical procedures that are out there, that are available to save people who, you know, previously would not have been able to be saved. So you're supposed to explore every single option before you give up hope. Yes, at a certain point in time, you say that it's appropriate to let the death take its course, but only after really everything else has been exhausted. In the few minutes that I have left, I wanted to speak about the notion of planning financially. So planning financially, that is also something which is very important. We believe in the idea of a tzavah, that a person should leave behind some type of a will, a last will and testament regarding what they want. In the olden days, the great rabbis would have an ethical tzavah, like Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, have an ethical tzavah. I think that my descendants should all follow these particular ethical principles and practices that I'm outlining. Okay? Ethical tzavah is very, very important. But even when it comes to finances, there's a little bit of a conundrum in halakha. Namely, you're not allowed to change the laws of Yerusha. Laws of Yerusha are sacrosanct. It says there are certain laws of inheritance. Sons inherit and daughters don't inherit. Right? Okay? Works for me. I'm an only son. Works fine. But it also, there are also laws. The firstborn son gets a double portion. All kinds of laws that are out there. A certain per stirpes type of allocation. Per stirpes is a legal term of what happens if one child dies and they have a bunch of children, so they all get, they share basically what portion would have gone to the parent. So we have, if there are no sons, then the daughters do inherit. Okay, different rules that are followed in terms of the laws, the Jewish laws of inheritance. A person has, let's say, two sons, two daughters. They want the sons and the daughters to inherit equally because it's going to cause big friction in the family. If only the sons inherit and the daughters don't inherit, so they want the daughters to, they like the daughters. So they want the daughters to inherit also. So what do you do from a halakhic perspective? So there are ways in which you can see to it that the heirs who would not have otherwise inherited, or the relatives, individuals who would not have otherwise inherited according to Torah law, will be able to receive some sort of a portion, because there's an idea of giving matanos. You can give gifts in your lifetime. You can give away all. You can give away practically all of your money as gifts to individuals, and that's going to be 100% valid and kosher. So therefore, let's say you give away a major gift 1 minute before the person dies. So that's going to be a valid gift. So the Moshe Isserles recorded a practice. This is already going back to 16th century Krakow, that he recorded a practice in Poland. He recorded a practice that they would have a shtar chatzi zocher. A person would make a will in which they would see to it, kind of like a half Nelson, right? That the woman would receive half of what the daughters would receive, half of what the sons would receive. That was considered to be good enough in those days. So how would they achieve that? The person, let's say, had an estate worth 10,000 rubles. So they would say, I'm giving a gift of 100,000 rubles to my daughter, and it shall be effective 1 minute before death. So then it's effective, it's a gift, it's effective 1 minute before death, and all of the person's assets are pledged to pay this debt, this gift of 100,000 rubles. The person only has 10,000 rubles. Maybe they'll make 50,000 rubles by the time they die. Not going to make more than 100,000 rubles, so their entire estate is going to go to their daughter. But they say that if the sons follow whatever I've written in this document, which is called the Last Will and Testament, if they follow the terms, even though it's completely unenforceable as a matter of halakha, because the Last Will and Testament says that the sons and the daughters are going to inherit equally, so then this debt shall be both null and void. So therefore, the Last Will and Testament becomes effective not because halakhically it would have been effective as an inheritance, but it's effective because the sons, meaning the rightful heirs, are voluntarily implementing the terms so that they won't lose all their money. Because otherwise they're going to lose all their money, because all the estate is going to have to go to pay off this debt. So nowadays, the post-game all recommend that instead of doing a shkatzi zakh or a half Nelson, they do a full Nelson, that the daughters should get exactly the same as the sons. In the olden days, they would have the will that would say the sons get double, what would it be? That the daughters will get, you know, one quarter, and then and the sons going to get one half, and each of the daughters will get one quarter, whatever. So now it's done in such a way that it's just going to be, you have, let's say, two sons and two daughters, 25% for each. Okay? So as long as you execute this halakhic will, what we call a shtar zachar shalem, it's going to be a document that gives really all of a person's assets to the daughters, unless the sons honor the terms of the will that split all of the money of the estate, all the assets of the estate equally between the sons and the daughters, so then you can achieve this result, and that's perfectly legitimate according to halakha. Why isn't that a harama? Doesn't that sound like we're trying to sort of get around what the Torah would otherwise require us? Well, remember what it says with respect to Avram Avinu. It says Avram Avinu gave to Yitzchak. He gave everything that he had in terms of inheritance to Yitzchak. And then to the daughters of the Pilakshim, the sons of the Pilakshim, because he had a lot of concubines who weren't from Sarai, he had hunger, he had the concubines, and he had sons of them, so he wanted to give them something too. So he gave them matanos. He gave them gifts. So that's what I always argue. That's our source in the Torah, that it's okay to do this. At least you do it in the form of giving gifts. So that would be okay. So there is one consideration, which is that the Gemara says, that Shmuel the Yamoma told Rabbi Yehuda that you should not be amongst those who obliterate the Torah scheme of inheritance entirely. So how do you avoid that? So the Mephoshim, the Poskim, will say, so just isolate a certain amount of the estate that is in fact going to be distributed according to the Torah laws of inheritance. Person usually has Svarim, they have holy books. So how much are the daughters going to study the Svarim anyway? Nowadays, they might study them more than the sons. Okay, but at least in many cases, the sons are going to be using the Svarim more than the daughters. So you say that the Svarim shall be allocated according to the laws of Yerusha. The Svarim will only go to the sons and not to the daughters. The oldest son, if there is a firstborn oldest son, will get a double portion with respect to the Svarim. So you could do it with respect to the holy books. Or you set aside a certain amount of the estate, $1,000, $2,000, and you say, okay, $1,000 or $2,000, that should all be distributed according to the Torah laws of inheritance. And the other $500,000 in the estate, whatever it is, shall be distributed according to the last will and testament that will be enforceable based on having signed this document of indebtedness. The shtara chasi zocher, shtara zocher shalem, it enables a person to give to daughters, or it enables a person to give to the wife. The wife doesn't otherwise inherit from the son, otherwise they just get the ketubah this way, they can give a major gift to their wife. So this is the mechanism that we recommend nowadays, but if you don't do it, you'll say, oh, my children will follow what it says in the will anyway, keep it avim. Don't count on it. I see a lot of rip-roaring battles sometimes after people pass away with respect to the children fighting over the estate. So it's better to dot your I's and cross your T's and to do a halakhic will so that there won't be any kind of actions that are going to be brought in Beis Din that somebody says, oh, halakhically, I'm entitled to all the money, even though the last will and testament says otherwise, I'm entitled to more of the money. So you want to avoid those problems. The puppet's dying. And his Sefer HaFas Chesed gives a good piece of advice. He says, if you're going to listen to me, I wouldn't leave over such giant estates for the children altogether at the time of death. Spend your money. You want the money to go to its chesed, to its tzedakah. Don't count on your children to have it go to its chesed and tzedakah. You're just placing a major temptation in front of them. They're just going to fight over all the money. Maybe they'll squander the money away. Use the money yourself at tzedakah. Ma'ukva gave, according to the Gemara, 50% of his estate he gave to tzedakah. During your lifetime, you're not supposed to give away more than 20% of your assets to tzedakah, so you won't be dependent upon the public wheel. However, in death, so a person doesn't need to be supported anymore after they die, so they can give 50%, according to the Gemara, they can give up to 50% of their assets in tzedakah. The Chafetz Chaim said, don't dwell too much on the major wealth that you're planning to bequeath to your children. Just make sure that you yourself devote the money to the Torah mitzvahs and to chesed, and that'll be a bigger zuchus, that'll be a bigger merit for the future of your children, the future of your family as well. So I'll just conclude with the blessing that I began with, that through the zuchus and the merit of really planning through these issues properly, of having a halakhic healthcare proxy, having a halakhic will, of having the right people in place whom we want to entrust with the decision-making process, making sure that we have the right priorities, that our assets are devoted primarily for tzedakah and for chesed, and that we have the right type of hashkafa of ideology as to how to handle money that we pass on to the next generation. So we should all have the schus to enjoy Chaim Aruchim, Chaim Shel Shalom, Chaim Shel Bracha, Chaim Shel Tov.
Hi everyone, as Rabbi Gelman said, my name is Tamara Kushner-Groman. I am an attorney licensed in Illinois, and I run the legal services at CJE Senior Life. And if you only knew CJE a long time ago, let me tell you, it's all different now. So I do have some materials on the table. If you're interested in CJE programs, we can talk about those at another time. But I want to get into our topic for today. And advanced care planning, so much of advanced care planning is a question of how do I want to live my life and what legacy do I want to leave behind. I want to compliment all of you for coming today because this topic is hard. But I actually only learned as I became a professional in this area that this topic was hard. You see, my parents received their cemetery plots from my grandparents as a wedding gift. So for my whole life, it was not uncommon to talk about my parents' dying wishes at the dinner table. And in fact, when we went to see my parents, my grandparents' graves, we knew that those next two under the tree belonged to my parents. But that's not true for everyone. So I do want to start with a story. If you haven't seen or read this book, I highly recommend it. It's called Being Mortal by Dr. Atul Gawande. And in it, he tells a story. There is a gentleman who was diagnosed, he had a tumor growing on his neck. And his doctors told him he could have surgery. If he did not have surgery, it was a guarantee that he would become a quadriplegic. If he went forward with the surgery, there was still a 20% chance that he would become a quadriplegic. And he said, I want to go forward with the surgery. And the night before the surgery, he's talking to his daughter. And his daughter says, what if they need me to make a decision? What if something goes wrong in the surgery? What if I need to decide? And he says to his daughter, if I can watch football and eat chocolate ice cream, then my life is worth living. And the next day, he goes into surgery. And indeed, they were able to remove the tumor, but then he had major bleeding. The surgeon came out, said to the daughter, we can save your father's life, but it is a guarantee that he will become a quadriplegic. Do we have your permission to continue the surgery? You have 3 minutes to decide. And she said, well, if he's a quadriplegic, can he watch football and eat chocolate ice cream? And the surgeon said, yes. And she said, please proceed with the surgery. Indeed, he came out of the surgery. He had lost all use of his arms and legs. Over the next 10 years of his life, he wrote 2 books and authored dozens of articles. He understood what made his life worth living. And so, I often focus on this when I talk to people individually. What makes your life worth living? What do you want to preserve? And so we're going to talk in a few minutes about some games, actually, so that your dinner tables can look like my dinner table was growing up. So, power of attorney for healthcare. What are powers of attorney? This phrase, it's like powers of attorney, it sounds like it's going to be so complicated. But I have to tell you, this document is really, really simple to fill out. In fact, the first 4 pages of the document are just information about what is a power of attorney. So a power of attorney is a document that is valid only during your lifetime, with one exception. And that one exception is really important, especially in the context of halakha, and we're going to get to that one exception in a minute. But powers of attorney are valid during your lifetime. Who is my decision maker? That is the key of what you're choosing in this document. And that's what it says on the top, on page 5. Who's your agent? What's that person's name and address? Right? This is really simple, right? That's what we're filling in. And then it says, what can my agent do? Well, my agent can decide to accept, withdraw, or decline treatment. My agent can admit me or discharge me from a hospital. My agent can have access to my medical records, right? And then we get to number 4. And number 4 is crucial. Number 4 says, my agent has the obligation that can make decisions, including carrying out the plans I have already made about the disposition of my remains. What do I want to happen to my physical body after I die? Now that brings me to another story that was just published in Mishpacha magazine in March. There was a woman who had lived her whole life as a secular Jew, not really connected much to religion, strong connection to the state of Israel, but not much in practice. And her whole life she had said, I want to be cremated. That is of utmost importance to me, and she signed all her documents. I want to be cremated. At 97, she became close again with her nephew. And her nephew was a Baal Teshuva. And through learning with her nephew, she changed her mind. And she said, I want to be buried, and I want to be buried in accordance with Jewish law. But did she change her writings? She never got around to it. And when she died, and she was 104, there was a court battle. Because her nephew pleaded, right? She wanted to be buried, but the rest of the family said, no, we have all these papers. And all these papers say she wanted to be cremated. And the judge sided with the papers. So to know the importance of these documents and making sure that your wishes are known is so imperative. Now, who needs to know your wishes? Number one is your agent. Now, how do you choose an agent, right? Hey, I'm the parent of twins who are my oldest. How do I choose which one, right? How do you choose? And I have to say, you got to talk to them. You got to talk to the people in your life, because one of those people might say, you know what? It would be really hard for me. I'm really squeamish. Please don't make me go to the hospital more than I have to. Or you might have an adult child who is in the medical field. So you might say, you know what? That's the person. They're going to really understand it. They're going to talk to the doctors. What if my children have a different hashkafa than I do? Right? Well, is my child willing to talk to the rabbi who I am designating? Right? And if that child, if that adult child says, no, I'm not comfortable with that, it's okay to then say, you know what? I love you with all my heart, but I don't want you to be my healthcare proxy. And it doesn't have to be your spouse, and it doesn't have to be your adult child. It can be your cousin. It can be your friend. It can be your rabbi. So, what if somebody, the common question I get, I want both my kids. I'm going to name them together. I want co-agents. And that's not a good idea. We don't assign co-agents because two people can disagree. And if you have two people disagreeing and it's at a hospital bed, then you end up in guardianship court, which is what these documents are designed to avoid. So as hard as it is, pick an agent. You can pick a secondary agent. You can pick a tertiary agent. My parents have four children. I am fourth on the list because I'm the youngest. Okay? And my parents have two children who are estate planning lawyers. Right? It's okay with me. Hey, this is great. I don't want to be the decision maker. Right? That doesn't mean I can't comfort them. That doesn't mean I can't engage with my siblings. Right? But ultimately, only one person gets to be the decision maker. Now, the halacha, what does it mean to see an attorney to go through these documents? Now, I can tell you most attorneys in the Jewish community know about these documents. And I can tell you personally, I have partnered with rabbis in the community to fill out these forms. Because people come and see me at CJE and they say, wait, I'm not sure what you're doing is kosher. And I'll say, okay, let's bring that other person into the conversation. Let's do this together. And the rabbis are happy to partner with me, right, to do this together. Oh, and because I didn't mention it before, I will also mention that all of CJE legal services are free of charge to anyone age 60 plus who lives in Illinois. Okay? I'm not the only attorney on our team, but I will say, come see me. We can talk. How do we have these conversations, right? If you didn't grow up in a house like mine, how do we have these conversations? There's actually games, believe it or not. On the table is a copy of this card game. It's called Go Wish. Not Go Fish that we played when we were little, but Go Wish. In it is a series of cards. Now, many of these things are things we all want at the end of life. To be mentally aware, to die at home, to be free from pain. And the way the game part of this works is that I take the cards and I sort them into most important, somewhat important, and not important. And my agent takes the second deck of cards. And my agent sorts the cards in the way that my agent thinks I am sorting the cards. And it's amazing, the conversation that can come from that. And I have to tell you, we played this game with my father a few months ago. But a few months before he died, we gave him the cards. And it was surprising to all of us that to my dad, he said, to be at peace with God was one of his top five. He only had five cards in his top five. And to be at peace with God was one of them. And so you know what? At the end of his life, we made sure that his rabbi was present, that he said vidui with his rabbi, that he got to pray as much as he wanted to, that we talked about God. You know, two of these cards are hard. And I asked my dad this question, because these two cards say to be free from pain and to be mentally aware. And they were both in his top five. But which one takes precedence, right? What if the medication that allows you to be pain-free also makes you sleep for 22 hours a day? And so these are the types of discussions that it's important for us to know. Right? There's questions in here about financial affairs, right? Not all of these questions in here are things that every person wants to have. I pulled out a few that were sort of obvious that most people want. So this game exists. I have it here. You're welcome to take these cards home. And it also exists online. So if the person who is your agent, and I get this question a lot, does my agent have to live here? Not necessarily. Is your agent willing to come here? Is your agent reachable? How much do you want your agent to be at your bedside? How much can your agent talk to your rabbi, to your physicians, etc.? Right? But does your agent have to live here? No. Another game I want to show you is called the Hello Game. Now, Go Wish is very much about end of life. The Hello Game is more about general life wishes, because there are many times that your agent is going to make decisions that are not life and death. And you want to empower your agent to make those decisions. So this game, in this game, each person has a little booklet, right? And one of the questions, some of them are very practical. If you needed help going to the bathroom today, who is the first person you would ask? In order to provide you with the best care possible, what three non-medical facts should your doctor know about you? Right? So there's a lot of good information in these little booklets, and there's instructions in the box about how to make it a game and a format to play conversationally. So I want to talk for a minute about other advanced care planning documents. One, power of attorney for property. Who's going to make my financial decisions if I can't make them myself? Right? So the focus of our conversation today is the healthcare proxy and filling out this form, and I'll go through the rest of the form in a minute, but we also have a document about finances. And what gets confusing for people is, well, what if I make my daughter my proxy for healthcare for finances, but I don't want necessarily her to inherit everything? But remember, powers of attorney are only valid during your lifetime. Once you die, your last will and testament takes over. So the person you name as your power of attorney for property is not the person who inherits from you. It's the person who writes the ComEd check if you're unable to write the check yourself. I started with the healthcare proxy. I want to go back to just explain a little more about what this document says, to just show it is pretty simple to fill out. The hardest legal question on this form is at the bottom of page 5, and it's the question of timing. When when do I want this person to start stepping into this role as my healthcare proxy? So option number one is the most obvious. I want the person to make decisions for me only when I cannot make them myself. The physician taking care of me will decide when I lack this ability. That one's sort of obvious. But number two is actually preferable. The second one says, make decisions for me starting now and continue after I'm no longer able to make them myself. But while I'm able to make them myself, I can do so if I want to. So I would suggest that someone should should make that choice. And the reason is because we don't want to delay. We don't want to delay. If you choose option one and your adult child or your spouse starts noticing a decline and has concerns about you, now they got to get into a neurologist. Have you tried to get into a neurologist lately? Well, you can have an appointment in 8 months. Okay? So in the meantime, HIPAA is going to take over and say, nope, those doctors aren't going to talk to you. Okay? Because this says only when a physician says you can't take care of it yourself. However, if you choose number two, keep in mind you are choosing a person who you trust with your life and death decisions. There's no reason not to choose the second option and say, of course they could step in now, but really for the time being I'm making my own decisions. But if they see something wrong, they can immediately step in and start getting in touch with doctors, therapists, etc. Page 6 again, very simple. We're filling in the name of a rabbi and a successor rabbi. Page 7 is rather important, especially if you have family who doesn't live here. And that's, what organization am I connected with? If these rabbis aren't available, whose else is on that tree, right? We hope, we all fill out these documents with the hope that we never have to use them, right? However, which organization do we want, okay? If the rabbi's on vacation and the successor rabbi moved away, whatever it is, which organization do I want to make these decisions? After that, there's an effective date, you sign the document, you can put alternate agents, but that's it. These documents are actually much simpler than people think they're going to be to fill out. A couple other tools, and then I will leave time for questions. This is a document. They're over there. They're also available on the CJE website. Now, the inside of this document doesn't follow exactly the phrasing in the halakhic medical directive, but the key ideas are the same, which is how do you choose an agent? What's your agent going to do? What if you don't choose an agent? What happens then? Right? The state of Illinois has decided for you. The state of Illinois has said if you do not choose an agent for yourself, if you're under guardianship, well, your guardian makes choices. Number two on the list is your spouse, and number three on the list is your adult children. Adult children? Well, which one? Whichever one is there to make the decisions. So instead, fill out this document, and then you decide who makes those decisions. Sometimes people say to me, oh, I don't want to do powers of attorney because that's giving up control. And I would push back and say, filling out a power of attorney retains control because you are choosing the agent and you are choosing the rabbi. And that keeps the control with you. So in this document is, the first few pages are much of what we just discussed about how you choose an agent and where the agent should be. And then we get to page 6 of this document, which is my healthcare goals and preferences, right? There's a lot of people who say, oh yeah, it's definitely my preference to not be connected to all those machines. But there's a lot of gray between I'm walking around fine and I'm connected to all those machines. So how do I feel about being able to communicate? How do I feel about being able to get out of bed? How do I feel about where I live and what I see? Right? So again, these aren't questions to discuss with your lawyer. These are questions to discuss with your healthcare agent and possibly with your rabbi. Now, some people tell me, oh, I don't want to burden the rabbi with all that. Right? The rabbi's got more important things to do. Okay? And I'm not a rabbi, but I can tell you, the rabbis want to hear from you. Right? If these are your concerns, how do I have these questions? How do I have these discussions? Right? I'm not sure where to start. Call the rabbi. Make an appointment. Call me. I'll talk to you anytime. I definitely have families who come see me as a family. I have families who come see me with only one of their adult children and not the others, and I shouldn't tell the other adult children, well, don't worry, because anything anybody says to me is confidential. Lawyer-client privilege. I can't share anything. I won't acknowledge knowing you in the grocery store, nor will I alert the community of your end-of-life wishes. The one last thing that's over there that I think is really important, especially when it comes to halachic emergency medical decisions, is having one of these. Okay? It's a fridge magnet. It's a list here. The paramedics, and I have spoken to paramedics in Skokie, and I have spoken to Hatzela, they will spend 3 seconds scanning your fridge to look for one of these. Right? Put your agent's name down. Put down your major medications. We're all on vitamin D. Everybody's vitamin D deficient. Nobody needs to know you're on vitamin D. But if you're on a blood thinner, if you have a heart condition, if you have diabetes, make sure those paramedics know, right? I will tell you, for any of you who live in Evanston, I don't know if anyone here does live in Evanston, Evanston does not want you to put this on your fridge. Evanston has a special freezer bag that they want you to put the file of life in your freezer. So if you live in Evanston, you can go to the Evanston Fire Department to get one of those. What I really want to encourage you all to do is to start having these discussions, to involve legal counsel and rabbinical counsel in creating these documents, because together we can really empower people. We know that people who fill out these forms live better lives and die better deaths. And that's a gift we want to give to ourselves and to our children. I'm sure we have a ton of questions and only a few minutes before Mara and before Minchon, but we'll take what we can.
And if you could address questions to either Tamara or Reese, thank you so much.
Hi, I've been carrying around my wallet the Halachic Organ Donor Society card. Are there any documents that we're supposed to be filling out for organ donation? I mean, I don't see any, or is there a separate document, or is there a card that's supposed to be?
Organ donation is a separate topic, really. It has to do with end-of-life decisions, but there's a major dispute regarding what is the definition of death according to halacha. So according to most authorities, I would say, death is defined by the cessation of cardiac and respiratory function, which means that at that point in time, there really isn't an ability to harvest a person's heart or a liver. In many cases, not even the kidney, at that point in time, once the person has had cardiorespiratory failure. So those organs are mostly going to be relevant in terms of a person who wants to donate them upon death, if they choose to define death, or their halakhic authority defines death as brain death, which is the cessation of all brain function, including the brain stem. And that was the definition that was accepted by Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, Zichrono Livracha, who was my own personal rabbi growing up in Muncie, New York. There's a big controversy whether his father-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, subscribed to that definition of death or not. There, most of the tshuvos that are published in the Egros Moshe, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, don't seem to subscribe to that definition, and there's one letter that was posthumously published that says otherwise, that people don't know quite how to reconcile all of the different shulas. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach also was not 100% comfortable. He gave certain criteria through which maybe it could be defined as death, but was very uncomfortable with the notion of using brain death as a standard from which to harvest organs. So it happens that the halakhic organ donation society
almost, I think, sort of promoted the notion of bringing that being the definition of death, and therefore it was more practical to speak about the donation of all of these organs. If one doesn't accept brain death as a definition of death, then one could donate a cornea, and there are various other things that one could potentially donate.
But it's not as much. So what a person could say is that in consultation with my rabbinic authority, I would like to be able to donate organs to the fullest extent that my halakhic authority feels that it's appropriate under the circumstances to do so, and that's perfectly fine. This particular card is not going to be so functional because they've basically blown up that organization. They've renamed the organization. It's no longer called the Halakhic Organ Donation Society. It's called the Imatai, with some weird symbol to indicate the first letter, and that is more of a focus upon end-of-life issues at this point in time, and is trying to be more collaborative with a broader range of halakhic authorities when it comes to these issues as well. We can certainly say that that is your preference in consultation with your halakhic authorities, and that would be a perfectly fine thing to do.
So is it better that I not have this in my wallet, so the agent... In other words, whoever I'm appointing as agent is making decisions. Is this going to be a problem for me to have this in my wallet and also have an agent making these medical decisions?
Well, what does it say? Does it appoint an agent? Or does it
this is just that one of the two choices. Like you said, brain death or cardiac, you know, that's all it has. Doesn't have it.
Well, if you consulted with the halakhic authority and you've decided you're comfortable with the definition, with the brain death being your definition.
But I think it sounds like it's better that I not have it and let the agent make the decision.
I would recommend that it be a halakhic authority you're comfortable with to make those decisions and to include that in the agent making authority. That would be my personal recommendation.
My question is for Dr. Weiss. Dr. Rabbi Reese, if you have financial resources that are in a bank or in a pension fund, and they are surrounded by a condition of transfer on death, let's say to your children, something like that, do those monies count as ones that as being subject to the idea of the firstborn getting, let's say, a double portion or not? Because you don't actually have their at the bank or their at the pension fund, do they count in that?
It's a really excellent question. There's a concept of mitzvah l'chayim d'vrei ha'mes, which means that there is a special mitzvah to fulfill the wishes of the deceased. If the deceased indicated that they want assets to go to a particular person, it might be separate and distinct from the estate. This is the opinion of Rabbein Tam, which is quoted by Tosfos, which says that this principle of mitzvah l'chayim d'vrei ha'mes only applies to assets which are hushlash b'yad acher. Assets which are already escrowed with a third party. So if a person puts a number of assets in a trust document, for example, and they appoint a third party trustee, it can be a co-trustee, but they have at least a third party trustee other than themselves who is responsible for directing and distributing the assets. So many authorities, I would subscribe to this position myself, are of the opinion that's considered to be escrowed in the hands of a third party during the lifetime, and therefore the principle of mitzvah l'chayim d'vrei ha'mes would be applicable to those assets. So if you had a pension assets, for example, which is similarly were in the hands, let's say, of a third party trustee or administrator who was in charge of distributing the assets, and that was already put into place in your lifetime, and you designated a beneficiary, so it's very likely that that would be separate and distinct from the estate, and according to the mechanism of mitzvah l'chayim, that would go straight to the beneficiary.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking the question. It's an important question.
Just one quick question. You said you're not supposed to, you have to give the person food and hydration and air. So, if an oxygen. So, if a person, that doesn't mean you have to intubate.
It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to take extreme measures of intubation or even putting in feeding tubes, certainly not a tracheostomy. These are case-by-case determinations that have to be made with the halakhic authorities in consultation with the medical practitioners.
Is that an infection take the person's life so they can hold them in their lives. Is that forbidden?
But Moshe Feinstein felt that was forbidden. He felt that all of the routine treatments that you would typically give a person, let's say for an infection that could be cured, even if they had a terminal illness that couldn't be cured, but they had antibiotics that could treat an infection that could be cured, he felt that that had to be maintained. A person is a lifetime diabetic and they get insulin, so he felt that should be maintained. So he felt that because that's separate and distinct from whatever the terminal condition happens to be.
Mm-mm. That's not true.
My mom, you called the hospice and you were giving your antibiotics, and they said, until you're through the antibiotics, you can't take it.
We could discuss after, but hospice. having just gone through it in the last 6 months.
It depends on the hospice. There are good hospices and there are not such good hospices. There are hospices that work closely with rabbinic authority. Chaim Arukim, here in the Chicago area, worked up a partnership program with Seasons Hospice, for example, where there would be close consultation with rabbinic authorities and they would respect the wishes of the rabbinic authorities in terms of the treatments that needed to be carried out according to Jewish law. When I was at Yeshiva University, we had a similar type of arrangement with Calvary Hospice Care, which is considered like the gold standard of hospice care in New York. I'm sorry, you wanted to add something?
No, well, I will say she never went into hospice. We said antibiotics, but actually she passed before the second dose.
Yeah, but now there are some hospice programs that really are top-notch. But you have to do your homework, like with every doctor in every hospital, so with hospice programs.
So thank you so much to Reese, to Tamara. This was a fantastic, very, very important conversation. A starter. We need much more time for this.